welcome to The Signal. I'm Sarah Kromolowski.
And I'm John Marshall. We're with the Audio Workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism.
Today on the show, long-term care in shambles.
We need to stop talking about fixing it and start to fix it. We need to stop studying the fixing and start doing the fixing.
Drew McConnell examines the frail state of Nova Scotia's long-term care sector and what's being done to nurse it back to health.
And emotional push-ups. Dr. Jackie Kinling will tell us about the ways to keep our minds mentally fit during Omicron's rampage.
Your brain is like any other muscle in your body. And so, you know, if you don't exercise it, or if you focus and only exercise one part of it, it can become kind of rigid or stiff.
Four more, three more. You get the picture.
Plus, later, I'll tell you about a little known part of African Nova Scotian history. All that and more on today's show.
This week's frigid weather and chilling winds kept many people indoors, but for some, there was no escaping the cold. Now, Halifax Council is promising more money to finish the long-promised emergency modular housing for homeless people, but critics say it's coming too late to shelter people from the worst of the winter season. I have a report on that, and we start with a walk on Spring Garden Road. On a frigid day this week, people on a windswept Spring Garden Road are bundled up in thick jackets, heavy boots and gloves, and wrapped in scarves. But in these temperatures, minus 16, there are others, sitting outside the doors of businesses.
You have a good day, thank you.
Begging for change. On that same frigid day, Halifax Regional Council voted to add $1.2 million to their Crisis Accommodation Fund. The motion was recommended by Chief Administrative Officer Jacques Dubé. He says it's needed to complete planned modular housing projects in Halifax and Dartmouth. So far, they've cost $3.2 million.
Yeah, we need this already today to proceed in order to complete. These costs are real. The timelines today, in order to get an answer, I mean, there's no turning back. We need to finish the job and get that work done.
Council agreed unanimously, but some had reservations. Councillor Tony Mancini.
The challenge I have here is here we are again, throwing money into this crisis as we should be participating. And we all know who's supposed to be the lead on this. The lead on this is supposed to be the province of Nova Scotia. My question is to maybe the CAO or whomever, have we made an official request to the province of Nova Scotia where they would cough up $1.2 million, as I believe, and many of my colleagues believe they should?
The city first promised modular housing last fall at two sites, Dartmouth and Halifax. The Dartmouth project is expected to be finished within the coming weeks, but the Halifax homes have been delayed. Again. Completion is now expected by mid-March, leaving people out in the cold for most of the winter season. This has some people worried. Advocates for the homeless are critical of the delays and accuse the city of foot-dragging. Despite the criticism, Councillor Sam Austin believes the modular housing project is a success story for City Council. He points to the speed of the Dartmouth project.
What HRM has done here is pretty darn awesome. We have brought 24 units into HRM that didn't exist before and created a semi-permanent home for out of the cold who has not had that in just 4 months. 4 months. No one else has managed anything like that. That's pretty incredible. And when the Halifax sites come online, hopefully in March, we'll have added space basically for a quarter to a fifth of that homeless population that our CEO was just referencing.
When construction is finished, 26 people will live on the Dartmouth site in single rooms. Another 38 people will live at the Halifax site when it's ready, hopefully in March.
Omicron variant continues to rage through the province, with record numbers of infections reported daily. This has many worried about staff shortages at Nova Scotia's long-term care facilities. But as The Signal's Drew McConnell found out, it's a problem that predates the pandemic. And those on the front lines are again sounding the alarm.
We need to stop designing systems around providing the bare minimum of care.
Janet Hazelton is the president of the Nova Scotia Nurses Union. This week, she gave a speech to the Nova Scotia Legislature's Standing Committee on Health. She said there's a severe shortage of registered and licensed practical nurses, nurse practitioners, and continuing care assistants. Hazelson says it's an issue that can't be pushed aside.
We need to stop talking about fixing it and start to fix it. We need to stop studying the fixing and start doing the fixing.
Hazelson says staffing levels have been a problem well before COVID-19. She also says residents of long-term care require at least 4 hours of individual attention each day, including more than an hour with a nurse. Currently, she says, that's simply not possible.
Staff are struggling every day to meet the needs of the clients and the residents that they care for.
CUPE Nova Scotia President Nan McFadgen told the committee that staffing shortages for positions like continuing care assistants boils down to dollars and cents.
I bring you a simple and clear message from CCAs, dietary aides, housekeepers, the full range of workers who work in long-term care. They are overworked and underpaid.
The average wage for a continuing care assistant in Nova Scotia is about $18 to $19 per hour, according to Michelle Lowe. She's the executive director of Nursing Homes of Nova Scotia Association. Despite the shortfalls in the system, Lowe says there is some reason for optimism. She points to the $57 million investment in long-term care announced last month by Premier Tim Houston.
So we're seeing new money coming in for international recruitment, domestic recruitment, support in other areas of the long-term care sector. So it certainly is giving us, as I said, that level of optimism.
That funding includes money to subsidize tuition for students enrolled in continuing care assistant programs at 11 NSCC locations and 5 private career colleges throughout the province. The educational programs have also been retooled to allow more practical, hands-on learning. The goal is to get prospective CCAs into the workforce more quickly. That said, Lowe still has some concerns about the staff due to the effects of Omicron.
This is having, you know, is compounding an issue that had existed before this particular wave. So I'm very concerned for the mental health and, that the wellness of the staff.
In the meantime, she says long-term care workers will continue to show up for work and do their part to serve society's most vulnerable. Drew McConnell, The Signal, Halifax.
This is The Signal. If you're looking for us on SoundCloud, just search King's Radio Room.
We're bringing you stories from the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism. I'm Sarah Krimilowski.
And I'm John Marshall. Still to come on the show, Sarah will tell us about an anniversary taking place on the Halifax waterfront this weekend. It's the little-known story of what happened to Black loyalists in Nova Scotia.
When we talk about staying healthy during COVID-19, we're usually referring to our physical health. Social distancing, washing our hands, and wearing masks is effective to protect ourselves physically during the pandemic. But how do we protect ourselves mentally? Dr. Jackie Kinley is a psychiatrist, professor, and author. She's also the founder of the Atlantic Institute for Resilience, and she has some thoughts on that. I spoke to her earlier this week.
So we're talking today about mental health, which is a term that we hear all the time, but don't necessarily always have a very good definition for. So I'll start with that. Mm. What is mental health?
You know, I think a lot of times when people talk about mental health, what they're really talking about is illness, right? We sort of live in a medical model. And so when people talk about, you know, their mental health, they're often talking about anxiety or depression or different things that are actually illnesses. So really, health is actually not just an absence of illness, but it's actually a, you know, state of well-being, right? So mental health would be, you know, people who are mentally healthy would, you know, feel good about themselves. They'd have lots of positive energy, positive emotions, strong relationship with themselves, which often people don't even think about. But also, you know, hand in hand with that, also strong relationships with other people. So healthy people have, balance life. They don't spend too much time in their emotions. They don't spend too much time in their thoughts. You know, they have a healthy balance of a whole range of emotions and a whole range and flexibility in their thinking. You know, all of those things are signs of health, you know, and so healthy systems grow. People that are mentally healthy are open to new ideas and they grow and they're able to tolerate difference and all of those things. So that health is a state of positive well-being.
And you wrote a book about this idea of mental fitness. Can you kind of explain a bit about that idea?
Yeah, well, I guess it goes back to the idea about sort of being open-minded and stretching yourself and growing and learning. You know, your brain is like any other muscle in your body. And so, you know, if you don't exercise it, or if you focus and only exercise one part of it, it can become kind of rigid or stiff or whatever. And mental fitness is the idea that, you know, that you just like any other muscle in your body, you have to exercise your mind. And there's certain areas of the brain, you know, that we know we have to take care of, right? We have to make sure that we, you know, practice being mindful. We have to ground ourselves. We have to learn how to tolerate emotions, all of those things. But, you know, those require practice, right? And if we practice doing those things, we get really, really good at it. And it's not because they're easy. They're hard to do, but we just get stronger. So your brain is like any other muscle. You can learn how to have a wider perspective. You can learn how to tolerate emotions. You can learn how to tolerate difference. You can learn how to think in a flexible and open way. And I'm not talking about with no boundaries and anything goes, right? Because, you know, we need structure as much as we need flexibility. It's a really hopeful model. And the great thing about mental fitness too, Sarah, is, you know, the idea that everybody has a certain level of fitness. Right. So same way you have a certain level of physical fitness, you have a certain level of mental fitness. And so I think COVID's really highlighted that is, you know, all of us need to take care of our mental fitness. None of us is immune to, you know, stress and injury. And I like mental fitness because it's very destigmatizing. Any of us can get depressed or anxious or paranoid, right? If we don't take care of ourselves, right? And so we have to actively practice and in a very deliberate and intentional way, just like going to the gym. It doesn't just happen. You have to be intentional. Same with your mental fitness.
You talked a bit about how COVID affected mental health and mental fitness. And this is obviously speaking of adapting to differences. This is obviously a time when everybody had to do a lot of that. So how have you seen COVID change people's mental health?
Well, I think what COVID has done, which I think is the sort of the silver lining in all of this, is it's highlighted a lack of mental fitness. I think we used to be able to get away with being kind of sluggish and haphazard and taking care of ourselves. Now, that said, even before COVID, 1 in 5 people were already struggling, right? There were lots of skills deficits, you know, that there's, you know, if resilience or mental fitness is something that we do, right? It's something we do. A lot of us weren't that great at it to start with, right? We weren't taking care of ourselves. So COVID's just highlighted that. COVID hasn't made us mentally ill. COVID is just another stress, right? COVID has just highlighted the fact that, wow, we really need to build our strength and our capacity to deal with stress. Because the only thing that's happened, bar's gotten heavier. it's added another level of weight. And so we have to get stronger, right? We have to get stronger to be able to sort of deal with that. So COVID has, for folks that weren't, you know, sort of taking care of themselves, and it has stretched them. And some people, it's really stretched them far, right? We've seen a lot more people struggling, you know, to take care of their mental health. I think there is a silver lining. And the good news is you have more control than you think. And there's lots of things that you can do, right, to be healthy and to be strong.
Yeah, so that would be my next question. Or what are some examples?
You know, in terms of what you can do, you know, I think it depends, you know, what you do depends on where you are. And so, you know, a lot of the, there's a difference between what I call languishing or sort of struggling and being exhausted and tired and frustrated and sad and scared and all of those things, which a lot of people are feeling. Okay. And that's pretty natural because we're under an awful lot of stress. And when you're feeling those things, it's really important to be deliberate and taking and start to take care of yourself, right? So bringing things back home, getting back to basics, right? Making sure you're getting enough sleep, make sure you're eating properly. You know, when you wake up in the morning, try to, you know, be mindful, set your priorities for the day. adjust your expectations about what you might be able to get done in a day, right? Maybe in the middle of the day, make sure you sit and be still and maybe be mindful, maybe get outside, go for a walk, practice gratitude. There's lots of really simple, basic things people can do, and talk about your feelings. Don't stuff them, because if you stuff your feelings, that's when people get in trouble, when they hold their emotions in. Right. But if you're beyond languishing, right, and if you're really struggling, you know, if somebody's depressed or anxious and really paralyzed by symptoms, which are different from emotions, you know, then you do need to reach out, right? Then you need to reach out and actually talk to somebody and, you know, see if there's something else that you might need, right? But for the most part, most of us are not in a totally depleted state. You know, our resources are low, so we need to refuel. It's about refueling, about taking care of yourself. I would say put on your oxygen mask, right? You know, so, you know, you're not going to be able to focus at school. You're not going to be able to do the things you want to do if you don't, you know, keep yourself filled up. So being deliberate, being intentional, those are things that anybody can do. And they might seem simple, and they are in some ways simple, but they have really profound effects if you do them.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else you want to say to people who are struggling right now with the during this Omicron wave?
Yeah, you know, you have more resources in you than you know and you think, right? We haven't even begun to sort of scratch the surface when it comes to our mental fitness. We're capable of so much. You have control over things and you do have choices. I'm not saying they're easy choices. I totally get it. But one foot in front of the other, you know, Belle always says, let's talk. I'm like, nope, no more talk. Let's walk. You have to start doing. Enough talk, right? There's certain things you have to do. And if you don't do those things, you're not going to feel better, right? You're not going to feel better staying stuck. People say, oh, I feel stuck, then move, right? Get moving. This is a movement. I like to think of mental fitness as a movement. So let's start moving in small steps. I don't care how big the step is you take, just take a step, right? That's where the success is in trying. So, and we can do it together, right? Collectively support each other. That's what's going to make the difference.
Dr. Jackie Kinley is a psychiatrist with 20 years of experience and a professor at Dalhousie University. She practices here in Halifax. She's also the CEO and founder of the Atlantic Institute for Resilience, which promotes mental fitness. This Saturday will mark the 230th anniversary of 15 ships leaving Halifax Harbor for Sierra Leone. Almost a third of Black loyalists in Nova Scotia at the time left that day to search for a better life. Yet many Nova Scotians have never truly heard the story. I talked to some people who are trying to change that.
Cynthia Dorrington is the site manager for the Black Loyalist Heritage Society in Birchtown, Nova Scotia. She is also the descendant of Black loyalists herself. She says that Nova Scotians need to do more to recognize the contributions of Black loyalists, including the people who went to Sierra Leone.
When you're walking along the waterfront in Halifax, nobody knows that ships left here and people left here in despair. They left for hope of a better way of life.
Black loyalists fought for the British in the American Revolutionary War. Many of them were escaped slaves. In return for their service, the British promised them land and freedom in what is now Nova Scotia. Professor Afua Cooper is a historian at Dalhousie University and the principal investigator for the Black People's History of Canada project. She spent a lot of time studying what life was really like for Black loyalists.
Many Blacks were actually re-enslaved. They were pressed into sharecropping. There were very limited job opportunities, very few of them. Received any land. They faced a plethora of anti-Black racism manifestations.
Thomas Peters was a Black leader at the time. After years of hardship, he traveled to England in 1790 to ask the king to keep his promise to the Black loyalists. What emerged was an offer to resettle in Sierra Leone. This enticement to attract them to Sierra Leone is still preserved in the Nova Scotia archives.
It is therefore declared that every free black man had a grant of not less than 20 acres of land for himself, 10 for his wife, and 5 for every child.
Almost 1,200 people got on those ships for Sierra Leone, about a third of all black loyalists at the time. For Dorrington, it's a story of hope.
It was all around protecting one's loved one, protecting yourself, and trying to forge a better way of life.
She says that it's also a story that more Nova Scotians need to hear.
History is powerful. It's just like when you know your root, you know the strength you bring to the table, you know the voice you've had, your ancestors and their contribution. It allows you to say that there is a pathway forward for your contribution. And I have run across people that are Nova Scotians and said, I didn't even know about this history. And I'm in my 50s or 60s, and I am totally appalled that this was not shared with me. And I think we have to take that and say, how do we make sure that this doesn't happen again for the next generation?
Karen Hudson is the principal of Auburn Drive High School in Dartmouth. She and her colleagues have been trying to do just that. Her students have been learning about the 15 ships this year as part of a public art project called Message in a Bottle. They wrote letters to the seafarers who left and completed art pieces in their memory.
Students are loving the history and want to hear more about it. And then drawing those similarities, and trying to understand both history then, but also it's still present day history as well.
Hudson says that the project is just getting started. For this 230th anniversary year, she will keep working with students and community leaders to honor the 15 ships. The group is calling it the 1792 Project. As for the students' letters, they will end up at the Maritime Museum, on the same ground where the 15 ships set sail 230 years ago.
Great story, Sarah.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening.
You can also hear us again on our SoundCloud page. Just search King's Radio Room.
Thanks to our producer, Drew McConnell, and our feature interview producer, Gabrielle Brunette.
A shout out to our technician, Mark Panio, in the control room.
Our audio professor is Pauline Dakin. I'm Sarah Krimolowski.
And I'm John Marshall. We'll be back next week with more stories. Have a great weekend.